From Flourish, this is the monthly interview series. I'm Margaret, a member of the Flourish team. Today I'll be talking with our guest, psychotherapist and author, Ken Page, about vulnerability, what it is, why it's important in dating and relationships, and how we can work through our fear of being vulnerable. Ken is one of our Flourish experts. He has developed a process that helps people uncover their authenticity and share it with bravery, generosity, and discrimination. It's so great to have you with us here today, Ken. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us and share your valuable insights. So, Ken, what is vulnerability?
Margaret, there are so many ways to understand what vulnerability is because it's such a rich, rich concept. But I'm going to start with the Latin term. And vulnerability comes from the Latin term vulnus, which means wound. So vulnerability is described as the state of being open to injury or appearing as if you are. And that's a kind of primal definition of vulnerability. But the real meaning of it is so much richer because, just like in the human body, those points where we have the most nerve endings are the points where we can be the most vulnerable to pain. But those same points where we have, in most cases, a huge number of nerve endings are also the points where we can experience the greatest pleasure, the greatest connection to ourselves, to the earth, to physical pleasure. So it's the same with our psyches and our being. In the places where we're the most sensitive, we can register and experience the most joy, the most beauty, the most depth, the most connection, the most love. But we can also be hurt the most deeply in those places. And one of the wonderful paradoxes, the amazing paradoxes of how we're built as human beings is that the places of our deepest vulnerability are those places where we can be wounded the most, but they're also the places we can be the most enlivened and the most joyful and connected and transcendent. So vulnerability simply means the places where we are most sensitive to the joy and the pain and the meaning and the experience of life and love.
Do people have misconceptions about what vulnerability is and isn't?
People have misconceptions about what vulnerability is, and I think that happens on so many levels because clearly one aspect of our beings where we're the most vulnerable is around our needs. And God knows in this culture we are what I call need-shamed. We're shamed for needs because we're told that they make us look insecure. And we're praised for a kind of confidence that's false because it doesn't include vulnerability. Hence, it doesn't include authenticity. And culturally, we're taught that vulnerability is a kind of embarrassing thing. But the truth is, our greatest power lies there. Our greatest genius comes from the place of vulnerability. And our greatest joy does too. So I'm just going to give you two images that can help us all think about this theme of vulnerability. So one of the images is the image of a flower, a beautiful flower. And if you could picture the green leaves that held that flower protected, those leaves are maybe scarred, they're maybe beat up, they're kind of woody, they're not as soft, and they're kind of more protective. But as you go in closer to the center, especially if a flower is just beginning to open up, those inner petals are just exquisite. They can be bruised really easily, but there's a vulnerability and a beauty to those inner petals. And it's kind of like that for us. The closer in we get to our deepest self, our deepest vulnerability, the more potentially beautiful we are, but the more we can be bruised and the more we can be hurt. Those tender, protected parts of ourselves are where we have the most nerve endings of our being. So here's the second image for everyone, and it's an image of a target. And I use this image all the time in my work. So if you picture a target, with some concentric circles in it. Just a normal, typical target. But now you imagine that this is a map of your psyche. And the closer in you get to the center, the closer you are to your vulnerability, the closer you are to your authenticity, to the parts of you that you treasure, to the parts that are really tender, really alive, really unique, the parts that are the most you. And those are sensitive parts in most cases. And as you go out further, there's a kind of more airbrushed version of yourself that you create, one that is still you, but it's a kind of easier for public consumption you. And as you go out further and further, you get more and more defended. You are more and more protecting those soft inner petals, more and more protecting the vulnerable parts by being less and less you. So as you do that, the world becomes colder. The world becomes scarier. We feel a greater sense of emptiness as we move away from that kind of heated core of our being, what I call the beating heart of our humanity. And as we move in closer, we're more alive. We feel more connected to our humanity. We can love more. We can embrace the world more, but we can also be hurt more at the same time. And so where we land on that target is a huge question. And usually what we try to do is we try to land in a place where we're close enough to the warmth and the heat and the beauty of that which lies in the center, but not so close that we feel we're going to get burned by it or that we're going to be too vulnerable. Now, the more we grow in our wisdom, the more we learn to honor those inner petals and dignify them and see their worth, the less susceptible we are, and this is an amazing thing, the less susceptible we become to our fear of rejection. And the less likely we'll be to spend time with people that chip away at those parts of ourselves. And the richer and the happier and the stronger we will feel in our lives. So there's a learning that has to happen here. And it's a learning about honoring and championing our vulnerabilities. And until we learn that, we're going to be ashamed of our vulnerabilities. And when we're ashamed of our vulnerability, we create patterns and circuitries of distancing. We create walls. We create distance between us and the people we love. And we create distance between us and us, between us and the most tender, vulnerable parts of us. And that means that our life is going to feel more empty and less connected and less warm. So there's a great journey here, but it's like kind of like walking up a down escalator or down an up escalator, because we're going against so much cultural conditioning. And I think this is a richer understanding of what vulnerability really means, because it doesn't just mean that we can be wounded. It doesn't just mean that we're susceptible to wounding. It means that we could be susceptible to joy. We could be ecstatic. We could be connected. We could be in a place of deep love and deep meaning. And our vulnerability is what allows us to do that. So another thing I'll say about this at this moment is something that Brené Brown said really wonderfully. She said, vulnerability is the first thing you want to see in another person, and it's the last thing you want to show. And I think that's true for just about all of us.
How does one know that one is comfortable with vulnerability or not? For example, I think to myself, well, I don't need to burden this person with my negative feelings, so I'm not going to talk about this thing that happened to me. Or I might, for example, be afraid to ask for help. Is that a fear of vulnerability? You know, what do you think? How do you know when you're comfortable or not with it?
So I have a lot to say about that. The first thing I want to say is we're human. And so when we step into our vulnerability, to some degree, it's going to be like walking through a ring of fire, a little ring of fire. And we do get better and better at that. It gets less and less scary. But there is an essential vulnerability in being human. And there's something that we have to walk through, and there's a click that has to happen inside that says, okay, this is a good thing. It may feel scary, it may feel really awkward, but I'm going to do this. I treasure this part of me. And yes, I will feel exposed. There's no way around the fact that I'm going to feel exposed. But if I do this and the person I'm talking to meets me and holds me and gets it, well, that's love. That's the feeling of joy and love. And that's a feeling of that we have a home in this world, or maybe could have a home in this world with that person. So there's a great joy on the other side of that ring of fire if the person is safe. And we really do have to use our discrimination around that. And the more you learn to honor your vulnerability, to honor those precious inner petals, which I'll say a lot more about that because there are reasons why it's challenging to honor those parts of ourselves. And I'll say more about that in a few minutes. But the more that you do that, the smarter you're going to get about who is safe to reveal those parts to and who is not safe. And that quality of discrimination, if you're taking this journey into vulnerability, you must have that matching quality of discrimination because you're not setting out to hurt yourself. You're setting out to deepen your life and deepen the love in your life.
So it sounds like what you're saying is we're going to reach that point where we feel that discomfort. And it's at that point that we have to ask ourselves, is this person safe? Do I trust this person to hold that precious petal? Right? That's what you're saying. That's how you know that you're coming up against vulnerability. Correct?
Yes, absolutely. And it's a really important question to ask. And of course you won't know the answer all the time. And even with someone you love and you treasure, sometimes when you do it, it's a leap. It's a gulp. It's an It's a flying off the trapeze into the air, hoping the other person is going to be there to catch you. But you have a huge net on the bottom if you have begun by saying, this is my need. This is my vulnerability. This is the thing that I want to share, and I'm okay with it. This is a worthy part of me. And we all need help in getting to that point ourselves. But it's one of the greatest tasks for achieving our greatness in life and love. The task of honoring the wisdom, the goodness, the tenderness, the mission inherent and embedded in our vulnerability. So there's inner work that has to happen too. But then there's also saying, has this person proven to be safe to me? Do they chip away at my sense of self-worth? Do I have this gut feeling again and again that they're going to tell me when I do this why I'm wrong? That they're going to tell me that I should feel a different way, that they're going to gaslight me again, that they're going to blame me, or that maybe just they're not going to match me in my vulnerability. Or maybe perhaps, as they've done before, I think they're going to respect me. I believe that they will honor me and treasure me. And I believe this person is someone who's capable of being that kind of person and has curated a life where that's how they really try to live. I think I have a really good chance of having this part of me held with a quality of honor and dignity and care. And when we feel that, then we make the leap. And it's still scary, and there's still a ring of fire. But there's a joy and an exhilaration when we are caught, when the person catches our hands, when we're seen. And it's just an amazing feeling when that happens. It's that feeling of, I can have a home in this world. And that is such an important thing for all of us to be able to feel. So that's a question for everyone who's listening now. Do you have people like that in your life? Have you had people like that in your life? And there's a tiny practice, which I call a micro meditation, which will help you grow, which will help you honor your vulnerability. and will help you deepen into your vulnerability. It's a tiny practice, and it's really lovely, and you can do it in a minute. And it's simply this. Think of someone in your life, current or past, who has allowed your vulnerability to be present and honored it and validated it. And think of that person. And picture their face. And remember how it has felt to be seen and held and appreciated and safe like that, because it's a precious thing. And just take a moment to just thank them silently. Or if you're alone and you want to speak it out loud, you can do that. Or if you want to whisper it, you can do that too. But just thank them for this. Take a moment to do that now. Good. Because part of our work in this world, the work of having a truly rich life, is to surround ourselves more and more by people exactly like that. That's the greatest key to a life that feels kind of golden, kind of beautiful and meaningful and right for you, is to fill more and more to fill your life with people like that, and more to kind of take as much distance as you can from people who can't be that way with you. Now, obviously, does this make life easy and perfect? No. But does it make it gold? Does it make it rich with meaning? It does.
So it sounds to me like vulnerability is a wonderful thing to cultivate in all your relationships, but why is it so important, particularly in, for example, dating and in romantic relationships?
Yes. Well, okay, so, you know, there's an expression in journalism which is called burying the lead. So when you're a journalist and you bury the lead, it means you kind of take the juiciest part of the story, the most meaningful and important part of the story, and you kind of bury it. You don't really say exactly what it is. You don't give it the focus it deserves. Well, the lead in our lives is our need. Our need is the most juicy part of our being. And just like burying the lead, our needs, which are the most important, meaningful parts of our being, and in an intimate relationship, our needs are the most alive. So in these cases, when it comes to our need, we are most at stake in an intimate relationship. We are most vulnerable in an intimate relationship because it's with our partner that we allow our deepest needs to rest, to be present, to be exposed. So there's a lot more charge around doing it in these relationships because we're touching our need, we're touching our dependence, we're touching our vulnerability, and that is big and charged stuff. And that's why in an intimate relationship, it's so important to be able to feel and recognize our needs. And our needs are often at the heart of where we feel the most vulnerable. So I just want to say a couple things about that. First, I want to say that we often mix up need with neediness. So what are needs? Needs are, for example, desire for connection. The desire for so many things, so many different things. Because needs are more than just about I need this or I need that. Needs are kind of the heart of Eros. And when I say Eros, I don't mean just sex or sensuality. I mean the broader meaning, which is appetite for life, a desire to partake in the fruits of this world and of life in all its dimensions. And that's our juice. That's our Eros. And that's where our need lives. So needs aren't just simply saying, I want this, give me that. Needs are also the need to create, or the need to give, or the need to feel like our gifts are received, or the need to hold, or the need to be held, or the need to travel, or the need to have adventures, or the need to write a poem or to listen to music. Our needs are the promptings of that which lies in the center of that target. And if we think about the rich, rich spectrum of our needs, we see that our entire humanity lies there. So just as vulnerability has been given a bad rap, our needs have been given a bad rap. And that's why I say we get need-shamed in this culture. So there's a difference between needs and neediness. Neediness is what happens when we shame ourselves for our needs. Neediness is when we have a need and we're ashamed of it, so we can't dignify it. We can't directly ask for what we want. We can't honor it inside ourselves. There's a feeling of shame, so we kind of maybe passively, aggressively try to get what we want. Or we push the other person away, and then it's like that beach ball image. It comes popping up in a way that embarrasses us. And when those things happen, it registers as neediness. But what it really is needs that have been shamed. Needs shamed become neediness. Needs honored become our greatness and our ability to connect. And nowhere is that more true than in intimate relationships.
Right. So someone, for example, might feel that they need to more time with their beloved, but they're afraid to admit that because they don't want to seem needy. So they end up saying or doing things that are needy because they're afraid to speak up and say, you know, I just really would love to spend more time together.
Yes, that's exactly it. And it's a great, great picture of how that happens. So, for example, you're with somebody and you're in a relationship with them, or you're on a date with them and you have this need. Like you have this need that you just want to hold this person, let's say. Or you just want the hug to last a little bit longer. Or you want to have a kiss that feels less like a peck and more like a real kiss. Or you want to hear something that reminds you of their love for you, and you feel embarrassed by that. And you think, okay, why should I need that? And we all do this, I think, a lot. Why should I want that? Which is a lot of cultural conditioning. This kind of admiration of false confidence, of not needing, this adoration of independence versus interdependence, this adoration of kind of suffocating and burying our needs so that we look cooler and stronger. And when we do that enough, we start out by burying our needs so that other people can't see them. But in time, we bury them so well that we can't even find them. And there's a lot of cultural trending toward that. And that's part of why it's so easy to do. And then when we do that, some really interesting things happen with our psyche when we bury our needs or push them down, or in this case of the story that I just gave. So you're with this person, and let's say you're in this place where you really want to just spend some time holding each other. But you feel embarrassed and it feels kind of stupid, and you're in the middle of maybe doing the dishes, or you have to go out somewhere, or you could just sense that maybe this person is not in that exact zone themselves. So you feel, I have to just bury this. I cannot say this. This would be too embarrassing. This would be too weird. This would be mortifying. This would be too needy. And there's the beach ball. And what's probably going to happen when you do that? Well, if it's a little thing, if it's not a big deal, probably it'll just pass. But if this moment has more meaning for you, one thing that's amazing that's going to happen is that your psyche will register that experience as though you were just rejected by the person you're with, even though it's completely untrue because you never asked for what you wanted. Your psyche will register your inner child, your vulnerable self, those inner petals of your being will register that as this person did not want to give that to me, as rejection. Even though it's not grounded in reality, that's how our hearts often register it. So that's one thing that's going to happen. Another thing that might happen is that in moments down, let's say a little bit later in time, where you could be more vulnerable, like let's say you're walking down the street with this person and you want to take this person's hand, but you don't because you're held back a little because you're hurt, because you feel rejected. maybe you don't even let yourself feel the wanting to take their hand because you're kind of cushioning yourself, you're padding yourself, you're armoring yourself, because now you're just being a little bit cooler, you're being a little more adult, you're kind of, you are not going to be needy. And there's a cost to that. And that's an example when you don't even know that you want to hold the person's hand. That's an example when your needs are actually becoming a little bit buried to you. But now let's go back to this same story. The same story about vulnerability and intimacy. So you're with this person that you care about and you want to hug them. You want to lie down with them. You want physical connection. The first wiser step that we're talking about here is asking, okay, what's my need? And the second step is to honor that need. And the honoring of our needs is the heart and the soul of our wisdom and our beauty on this intimacy journey. When we learn to honor our needs and then the needs of the people we love, and let me just say that honoring doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get all your needs met or that you're going to meet all the needs of the other person, but it means that you kind of hold those needs with cupped hands. And when we do that, our wisdom and our capacity to bear the heat, the cool, the speed bumps of intimacy just increases so dramatically. We have less need to flee loves. William Blake said it beautifully. He said, "We're here but a bit of time to learn to bear the beams of love." And when we can do this, we are so much more capable of bearing the beams of love. So what is this process, this first stage of honoring our needs? I want to give you a physical gesture that I think will illustrate it and capture it verbally and physically. So this is about how we hold our needs. So just try this now if you can. Take your hands and hold them flat out, wide and flat out. And imagine you're holding your needs like that. Well, there's no warmth there. You're just a receptacle for its gravity and its presence. But there's no messaging of valuing. It's just these flat hands. So now, take your hands and imagine squeezing that need really tight. There's a kind of intensity there that might feel like you're not giving your needs enough space in that squeezing. But now, take your two hands and create a cupping shape together, like you were cupping water in your hands. And imagine holding a feeling or an emotion in that way. Feel what that would feel like. Can you feel the goodness in that? Can you feel the honoring in that? The space and also the cradling. So there you are with this person and you realize you want to hug them and you feel ashamed, you feel embarrassed, you feel weird, you feel awkward, but you think, what is the value? You hold those needs, that desire, with cupped hands. And you think, what is the value of this part of me? Oh yeah, this is the love inside my heart. This is who I am. This is a tender, beautiful part of me. This is that I love this person. Now, if this person is someone who would laugh at me, who would push me away, let's assume that's not the case now. Let's assume this is someone that could hold the warmth of our love for them. Someone who's not afraid of that kind of warmth from me. So I hold my need, my desire, my vulnerability with cupped hands, and I think this is a good part of me, and this is someone who can hold that. So, okay, I'm going in. I'm going to do it. And then you do it. You say to the person, You know what I would love to do right now? I know we need to get going, but I would love it if we could just take a few minutes and just be on the couch together and just hold each other because I'm feeling really close to you now. And then you do that. And it's wonderful and it's sweet and you're bonded and you're deeper. And then, now, when you're walking down the street 10 minutes later, you could be sure that the two of you are going to be holding hands after that. You can be sure that your heart is going to feel a lot more full. And you can be sure that you'll have a wonderful sense of connection and maybe not being so alone in the world. So this is just a story based on the example that you just gave, Margaret, and it's a great one, of how we can hold our vulnerability in a different way.
I love that image of the cupped hands. I mean, it's just, it's not clingy, and it's not, you know, like you said, it's not just kind of, ugh, holding this, but really just lovingly holding it with your cupped hands. It's a wonderful image.
It is a wonderful image, yeah.
What does it say about someone's childhood if they're afraid to be vulnerable? What does that say? I'm always curious about that. If someone's just really cold, really defensive, really sort of pushing away, what does that say about their childhood?
Yes, okay. So I'm going to say something about that. I'm going to say a few things about that. And I'm going to get into a little bit of a different take on attachment theory than we usually hear. But just starting with the specifics of that question first. I want to say all of us have had childhoods where we learned, all of us, where we learned to be afraid of our vulnerability. If we're breathing, we're going to be on some level afraid of our vulnerability. It's just part of what it means to be human, because we are dependent. We are vulnerable, and we are interdependent, and nothing can take that truth away. Hence, we're vulnerable to joy, and we're vulnerable to hurt. So for who is that going to be easy? Probably nobody. So I just want to make space for the humanity and the universality of this first. And then I want to say that if you grow up in a family where you show your needs and they're met with cupped hands, at least a good amount of the time, they're cherished, they're valued, they're listened to, and they're heard, you will probably be less afraid of vulnerability. But that's not always true. Because some people, especially people who characterologically, the nature of their character is that they have a lot of pride or deep inner privacy. And that might not have come from negative childhood experiences. It might just be who they are. Well, those folks are not going to leap out with their vulnerability in the same way as some people who just love sharing vulnerability and hearing vulnerability. So, to some degree, it's kind of also how we're built, and all of us are different in the ways that we hold and interact with our vulnerability. So I just want to make room for that as well. But if you've been shamed for your vulnerability, and chronically shamed around the areas of your vulnerability, you will have trauma-based feelings. You'll have an armor. You'll have a protection, and if there's been real trauma or real abuse, what abuse does, one way to understand it or think about it, is that it surgically bonds the most precious parts of our being to pain and shame and fear. And that is not an easy thing to change, and it takes work. It doesn't mean that it cannot be done. It absolutely can be done. And it's our job to be able to do that, to take the time to find the modalities, to find the support, to be able to do that. So I guess what I'm saying in many ways is that it does have to do with our childhood. And it might also have to do not just with our childhood, but, for example, maybe we were born with a physical challenge that other people don't have. Maybe we're a little bit shorter than we wish we were, or a little bit taller than we wish we were. Or let's say we were born with a gender identity that is not common, or that we got shamed for, or a sexual orientation, or a physical quality that people have shamed us about. These are all just different examples of how so many of us then become afraid of vulnerability. It says a lot about our childhood. It also says a lot about our character, and it says a lot about our development, the unique ways that we hold our vulnerability.
Well, let's say you're dating someone, and that person just doesn't want to go there about their feelings, their needs, their fears, their past mistakes. They just don't want to be vulnerable with you. Is there anything a person can do to encourage this romantic interest to open up and be more vulnerable? Is there anything you can do?
I would say absolutely yes. And the first thing is to stop and honor how they have been so hurt, why they're so afraid. And I just want to share a story here. My father, who passed away a few years ago, was a Holocaust survivor. And he met my mom and fell wildly and deeply in love with her. And she fell in love with him too. And they really had one of the best relationships that I've ever seen in my life. They were together for a really long time until his passing. 70 years. They were together 70 years. Anyway, at the beginning, he said to her, "There are two things I need to let you know." Her name is Hetty. And he said, "Hetty, there are two really important things. One is that I have no family to give you. My family has all been killed. And I'm coming to you with this really big deficit that I don't have a family that I can share with you." And he said, "The other thing is this. There are parts of my life that are a closed book. And they're always going to be a closed book. And I need you to respect that." Very emotional for me. Very, you know, amazing story. And I'll tell you more as I tell you more. But she said, "Yes, of course." She was also a Holocaust survivor. And she said, "Of course, Eric, I understand. And don't worry about the family. And I get it. That's a closed book, and I won't touch it." And, you know, by the end of my dad's life, and we're talking about many, many decades later, nothing was a closed book. By the time he passed, he had opened up about pretty much everything with so much love and so much tenderness and with great vulnerability. And it took a really long time. But my mom had to start by honoring that. And I think that's the place to start if we find that our partner, for whatever the reason, just can't. There's another piece here, though. And that piece is your partner able to make space for your vulnerability? Maybe you're with someone who is really vulnerable about being vulnerable, who just like can't do it, has a really hard time with it. But they have open arms for your vulnerability. They know how to make space for and value your vulnerability. Well, that is a big deal. And that's something that's really valuable. And if that's the case, you will get a good number of your needs just met by just being able to share your vulnerability. And over time, maybe you'll be inspiring this person, because if it's someone who can welcome your vulnerability with open arms, there's a good chance they'll be able to learn over time the beauty of doing that and the worth of doing that. Now, when you have needs that come out of your vulnerability, when you have needs that make you feel vulnerable, you do have every right to ask. You may not be able to demand. You can't force, but you could say, "I would love it if you could. Do you think you could? It would be such a gift to me if you could." And when we say things that way, instead of just getting angry, it really changes everything. One of the most fabulous quotes I know in all of my years of work around intimacy comes from Harville Hendrix, and he said, "Turn your anger into an ask." I love that. So maybe you can turn your anger into an ask and ask this person if they can do that. And they may do it in a different kind of love language than you would have imagined or thought of or even wanted. They might do it physically at night, just in the way that they hold you. They might do it by giving gifts to you. They might do it by sharing something that to you, it seems like, "Oh my God, that is vulnerability 101, if even. But to them, it's huge. And you need to see that and honor it and register it and make space for it and hold it with cupped hands.
Mm. And by the way, what a testament to your parents' love. that such a painful thing as being Holocaust survivors, that they were eventually able to share those stories with each other. I mean, that's beautiful.
Yes, yes, it is beautiful. And it was amazing to see, just amazing to see. And they had hard, hard stories, but the profundity of what they shared and the kind of love that they created with a lot of rocky times. I mean, they were human and they had a lot of trauma, but the love between them was so beautiful and so profound. At one point, when my dad was really sick and was dying and wouldn't eat, my mom was so mad at him all the time because he wouldn't eat. And sometimes at night, after a really rough day of fighting, they would just take each other's hands in bed and they would look at each other and they would say, "What are we becoming? We love each other." And that moment meant so much. And the next day they would go back to fighting again. But those moments where they could hold each other's hands and build a bridge across their differentness, build a bridge across their pain, ultimately served them in finding healing and peace around that whole issue.
Well, how does, for example, how do you handle feelings of embarrassment or shame about letting another person see you, like really see you? And, you know, I've had personal experience with this where I get super vulnerable about something to a friend, and then later I just go home and I just want to hide under the covers for a week, just mortified about what I told this person or let them see about me. How do you tell your clients, for example, how to handle those feelings of just, "Ugh, I'm so embarrassed. Why did I say that? Why was I so vulnerable?"
Yes, well, I have a lot to say about that. And also, first of all, I want to thank you for being so vulnerable, because that really was a gift to me as the person being interviewed, because you just opened the door and everybody, all the listeners, can hear this. What just happened in that moment? What did you feel when we went from the theoretical to the personal and Margaret was just vulnerable like that? What I experienced was the juiciness of it. As the interviewee, it excited me because there was so much I wanted to say about it. So, Margaret, you opened a portal with your vulnerability, and I'm so glad you did it, because you opened portals in this interview. And that's what happens in our intimacy life. And I really relate to that. I remember being in a group of other therapists and coaches and ministers, and it was a group where we were exploring the connection between sexuality and spirituality. And I revealed a part of myself that was wild and crazy, and it came out in full force, and it was silly and explosive and just wild. And I had been shamed all my life for that part of me. And in this community of people, I just let it rip. I kind of went wild. And I didn't even know what I was doing. I just let this out because I trusted these people and I had hidden this crazy part of me for a long time. And afterwards, I just felt like I wanted to die. I felt so mortified. But because of the lessons I had learned, and I wouldn't have been able to do this before, I was able to say to the community, "Hey, folks, I just have to interrupt for a moment here and say I'm kind of like dying of shame and embarrassment. I am so mortified. I want to hide under a rock and never come out." And it was brave and vulnerable of me to do that, but thank God I did, because that kind of is so healing. And a minister who was part of the group looked at me and she said, "Ken, I love that part of you. It was just crazy and wild and free and effusive. And I just love, I feel closer to you now that I've seen that wild part of you." And I was better after she said that. It really stunned me, though, how bad the feeling was. And I talked to my therapist about it, and she explained it in a really interesting way. She said, "Yeah, that's retribution. And retribution is this thing where you break the rules of safety that you had given to yourself, where you weren't going to show certain kinds of vulnerability or tender parts of yourself or parts of yourself you didn't feel sure of. You made a rule that you were not going to do that to protect yourself. And then as you grow, as you become freer, you need to break those rules. But you break the rule, maybe you feel great afterwards. And then it's like you throw a boomerang and it hits you in the back of the head 2 days later and you just feel horrible, 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 and you don't know where it's coming from. For me, I felt that right away, but sometimes it takes a while for it to hit. So I felt just horrible, horrible, and that was retribution. And it's when we break a rule in the service of our health, but some part of us, the voices, the guards at the gate that say, no, you can't do that. You cannot do that. That scream at us, that yell at us, that tell us we're not enough, that tell us we're going to get in trouble, that tell us we're stupid or we're ugly or we're too much or whatever. Whatever those guards were that we had to create so we didn't mess up in the world, those guards come out in full force. And that's actually something that happens as part of a healing experience. So, if you reveal a part of yourself like that and you're met with blankness or flatness, it's going to be really painful to you. Just like the experiments that they did where they had a mom with a baby. These were kind of very cruel experiments, I think. But the mom would have a completely flat face. And the baby would coo and would smile or would cry and want the mother to register their presence and to respond and to react. But the mother kept a flat face. Well, that freaked the children, the infants out in horror. It traumatized them. So when we share a vulnerable part of ourselves and it is met with honor, with appreciation, with cupped hands, there's a healing that happens. Somehow we learn to accept and treasure that part of ourselves. But when it's met with derision, or when it's met with flatness and a lack of care, then we can have a really, really bad experience of retribution. And then we need to learn to find the people who can cherish those parts of ourselves and learn to honor and cherish those parts of ourselves on our own as well. So all of us have built up armor. And it's our beautiful and precious work to find the people with whom we're safe and then take those risks and do it in ways that honor the other person and honor us and make space for the connection that forms. And when we do that, that's the hard-won gold of intimacy. That's true intimacy. That's truly growing as a human being who can love. And we feel it when it happens. And when we learn to honor and dignify our needs, and I'm going to say more about that. I'm actually going to teach you two exercises that will help you to do exactly that. But when we learn to do that, that's when we can have the richness of love that we want. And then, you know, they say intimacy is a process of rupture and repair. Rupture and repair. And when we learn these skills, we know how to bear the rupture and we know how to do the repair.
I'd like to hear some more about those exercises. I think now's a good time if you'd like to take us through one or two.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So here's the first one. This is an exercise that's very eye-opening, and it's a way to discover what I call your core gifts. And your core gifts are the most essential parts of you. They're the most vulnerable parts of you. And I haven't used this terminology yet in this interview, but these are parts that I call core gifts that are essential for our intimacy journey and our self-understanding. Our core gifts are our intimacy genius. They're where our deepest humanity lies. And they're a portal to our greatness, and they're not easy to handle. Because of their vulnerability, their originality, their tenderness, and their fierce passion. So, an exercise which will help you discover what those parts of yourselves are, your core gifts, and also, at the same time, help you learn to honor your vulnerability. So this first exercise is a self-contained exercise. It's one you can do completely yourself. So you get a journal, and over the course of maybe a day or two, you notice the things that fill your heart, that make you feel peace, that make you feel joy, that make you feel connectedness. You notice those things, you notice those moments. Instead of just kind of going past them, you take an extra moment, an extra beat to be with them, and you notice the things that touch you in those ways, and you write them down, and you make a list of them. You note the different things and what it was about those moments that touched you. And it's like a connect the dots puzzle. These are dots that when you put them together at the end of a few days, you will see a picture emerge, and it's a picture of your core gifts, because the things that touch and inspire you the most are from those center petals of that flower. The next part of this is that you notice the things that hurt your heart the most, the things that cause you pain, the things that maybe make you feel deflated or sad or angry. And you notice those things as well. And you mark them down, and then you notice, what was it in that that hurt me? And again, when you connect the dots after a few days, you will see a picture of your core gifts emerging. Because the places where you get hurt the most are places where your deepest compassion lies, where your deepest attributes for connection lie, where the parts of you that feel the pain of the world the most richly lie, and also where you're very connected to your passions and your needs. So those are precious parts of you too. So with our positive parts, we often just think, oh, that's nothing, instead of honoring them as portals to something deeper. And with our more painful emotions, we think, oh, I'm just being too sensitive, or I'm being too much. I'm asking you not to do that. I'm asking you to find the wisdom in those experiences and honor them. And because those are the points of our deepest vulnerability. So when you do that, it's like finding the user's manual for your own life. It's a beautiful, powerful thing. You'll understand yourself better than in some ways you ever have by honoring and validating those points of deep vulnerability in pain or in joy. The next exercise is a really great one too. When you feel moments of vulnerability where you maybe feel ashamed, or you feel, I can't say that, or it's wrong for me to feel that, or that's asking for too much, or I just got too upset about that situation. That wasn't right. That wasn't fair. Or any of these different thoughts, I'm going to ask you to try something different. I'm going to ask you to ask yourself, what was the vulnerability in that experience? What was the part of me that was vulnerable? What was the part of me that was vulnerable, and how does it make sense? And a way that you can do that is you can first write down the negative words that you say about yourself when you're experiencing something that you don't like, that doesn't feel good. What are the negative words that you tell you yourself about how you're too much, or you're too sensitive, or whatever it is? And then next to this, you write, it makes sense that I feel this way because, and then you fill in the blank. This is a part of me that maybe was never honored enough in my life. How has that been true? And you think about the answer to that. This connects to a deep and precious part of me, which is why I care so much about it. And here's what that part is, and you write that down. When you do that, you will be richly dignifying your vulnerability. And when that happens, there will be more of a dignity to you. There will be more of a flexibility, because after you do that for yourself, it's going to be easier to listen to the other person's side in the experience. But we are not trained to honor our vulnerability as the first act. And that's what we're talking about today, is how our world changes and who we become when we learn to honor our vulnerability starting from the beginning.
Those are certainly some powerful exercises and very easy to do. So I appreciate that, Ken. Yes. Well, earlier in the interview, you said that society shames us for our needs. Basically, gives us a sense of false confidence, or that we're supposed to have a false confidence. So this leads me to my next question, and that is there ever a situation where you probably don't want to show your vulnerability, for example, in a work situation?
That's a really important question, because we've talked a lot about what happens when you're in a relationship with someone who deserves the precious gift of your vulnerability, or you're in a situation where expressing that vulnerability is appropriate. So now it's wonderful that we talk about these other pieces. So let's just say a few things about that. You're on a date with someone. Vulnerability does not mean spilling your guts about trauma that you had when you were a child. It doesn't mean that you start asking things of someone you're on a new date with. It's really important that we understand what's appropriate in our expression of deeper vulnerability. And the experience of swinging out in terms of what you ask for is done best with people you love and know and trust. So yeah, all of us need to develop a somewhat objective sense of where it's appropriate to be vulnerable. However, I will say that our vulnerability is our genius. And genius domesticated is genius lost. So every once in a while, you might have an urge to say something that sounds really strange or is really taking a risk, but your gut tells you, I want to do this. I want to jump. And there needs to be room for those experiences in life. We don't always have to be appropriate. But outside of those situations, it's very important to have a sense of appropriate boundaries. What is kind of too much for a situation and what's not? And in a work situation where the goal is getting the job done, but in a good way, in a connected way, you might ask yourself, doing this, is this going to be something that is experienced by people as something that furthers our growth at work, furthers our business, our organization? And if so, it might be a good thing to do. But in any case, it's important to know where it's appropriate to share your vulnerability and where it's not, which is a different subject than treasuring it, because that's an inside job. That's something we can learn to do inside ourselves. And then in the spaces and with the people who can treasure those parts of ourselves, we can kind of let loose, we can share, we can exhale, we can rest in their arms and in their presence. So there's a question that I teach people in all of my work, and it's a pivotal and profound question that directly speaks to discrimination. And here it is. The question you can ask yourself, and that I'm encouraging you and inviting you to ask yourself, is, does my soul feel safe with this person? Does my heart feel safe with this person? We ask a million different questions first, and then maybe we get to that one. When you make that your first question, your choices on all levels, business, social, romantic, will shift on this new axis. They will kind of form and organize themselves around that first and primary question. Does my soul feel safe with this person? Does my heart, my deep heart, feel safe with this person? And of course, you may not know right away. It takes time to get to know that. But the question itself is one that dignifies your vulnerability. And when you can dignify your vulnerability, you become that much more of an amazing version of you. So if you're sharing your vulnerability and your soul doesn't feel safe with the person, and as you do more, as you do this work more, you're going to get more and more skilled at knowing that. You'll ask yourself, is this just my inner ring of fire, that it's just hard to share my vulnerability? Or really, 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 is this person someone who just doesn't feel safe enough? And in that case, it's best not to share those parts of yourselves. But if you can, because there could be a part of you that is aching to be shared, find another way to share it so that part does not have to get buried. Because it is so important that we don't bury our needs and our vulnerability. The space where our vulnerability and our needs should be, if we bury them, always ends up getting filled with masochistic situations. It's a quiet violence against our being, because we are burying a part of our being alive. So as we learn these lessons more and more, we bury our needs less and less, but we find appropriate people and places who are going to get it. And that's just such a wonderful feeling.
So vulnerability researcher and sociologist Brené Brown, who we mentioned earlier, she says that there's a difference between genuine vulnerability and boundaryless disclosure, the latter being attention-seeking behavior that's so rampant on social media these days. How do you see the difference between a healthy vulnerability and the kind that's more about manipulation?
So I'm going to talk to the folks who maybe feel like they do the latter, manipulation. And what I'm going to say is that you're doing that because you are not feeling seen enough, and you deserve to find ways to be seen more and more authentically. This is not about excising or lobotomizing our needs. It's never about that. It's always first and foremost about honoring our needs. And if you're needing to get a lot of your needs met through social media, I'd ask you to think, how much am I getting those needs met in nitty-gritty real life with the people who surround me? And if the answer is not enough, then it's really important to do something about that.
That certainly gives me a lot to think about, the idea of how do we really do vulnerability in a healthy way versus what you were saying, you know, as a response to some trauma or some need that we have in our lives to be more vulnerable that we can't express. And so therefore, you know, we get on Facebook and say some inappropriate things that shouldn't be said for all the world to see. So in closing, I have one last question for you, Ken. Was there a time in your life where you were afraid to be vulnerable? And would you like to tell us about that?
Yes, there was a time in my life when I was afraid to be vulnerable. And that time was and is every single day of my life. That's my easy answer. I'll get a little bit more specific, but I think that's a really important thing to say. But I will say more about that. So I grew up as a super sensitive kid in a family of Holocaust survivors. And they were smart and successful and beautiful people. But they were people for whom toughness was everything. And toughness is not what I was or who I was. Sensitivity was who I was. And so I didn't fit in. And I learned to be really ashamed of those parts of me that were the inner petals of my being, and wonderful. This is how I had the discovery that the parts of myself that I felt the most ashamed of were actually my greatest gifts. But the kind of dreamer in me, the ungrounded one, the one who felt knocked down at the knees by things in life that didn't feel right, or that felt such an exuberant joy when things did feel right and didn't fit into the world of my family. And then add on to that being gay and born in 1956 and growing up in a world which, although maybe slightly better at that point, it was like one of the most shameful and mortifying things that you could be, was gay. So I learned to hate, I mean really hate, those parts of me that felt so vulnerable, so exposed, so weak, that had been slapped, that had been spit on, maybe literally, maybe figuratively, but that's how it felt, that were so exposed and unprotected, and that terrible, bewildered feeling when you get smacked by life and you're innocent and you're vulnerable and you don't know where it comes from. So there's a way you learn to hate yourself. And I had a lot of self-hate in these ways. And this is an amazing thing. This is really what I call the deeper physics of intimacy. And it's so big. And it's this. It's the degree to which we dislike or dishonor those vulnerable parts of ourselves, like I just described, is the degree to which we're going to be sexually and romantically attracted to people and situations that are bad for us. And that was the story of my dating life for decades and decades. So I was attracted to people who shot me down for my vulnerability all the time, and I tried to get their love. So I had to relearn, because on some level I knew it when I was young, how to treasure those parts of myself. And, you know, on some level I did always treasure them, but on another level I despised them, and I was embarrassed. I was trained to hate them. So I again and again ended relationships. I was just incapable of keeping relationships alive, because when people got too close to me, that I felt they would see these spots, I experienced a self-hate that made me reflexively and unconsciously just want to get away. And as I learned through the help of therapy and finally choosing kind people with whom my soul felt safe and learning to stand up for my needs, as those things happened, my whole world really began to change. And does that mean that I don't flee my vulnerability still on a daily basis? No, it doesn't. I do. And that's why I keep needing to do practices with my wonderful husband and with our children and between me and me again and again, where I remember and experience the beauty of my vulnerability. A therapist once said something wonderful to me. She said the best antidote to an old hypnosis is a current relationship with its antidote. So I still have that old hypnosis. Its antidote is my feeling the beauty of my vulnerability, of those inner petals, those inner parts of my being, and surrounding myself with people who do the same. And there's so many practices that I do because I always need help for that. And, you know, an image that I have of that is of being at the beach and digging a hole, and the water keeps kind of filling it up again. And I keep needing to redig and redig down to those places of self-love, because life just keeps filling them up with sand again and again and again. So I just want to say that this is not a one-stop shop. This is an ongoing moment-to-moment journey. The learning is always. So I'm afraid of vulnerability much of the time, but I have committed myself to a profound love relationship with the essence of my inner self, and that has changed my life in marvelous ways and has led me to beautiful love and a rich, rich family life.
Ken, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners today before we wrap this up?
There is one thing. I just want to share this amazing paradox that the more we dignify, the more you dignify your vulnerability, the more you honor it, somehow the less vulnerable you will feel and the less fear of rejection that you'll have. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't always feel vulnerable to some degree, but what it means is that as you, as we, learn to treasure and hold with cupped hands our vulnerability, we choose different people. We choose people who are better for us. We avoid people who are less good for us. We find doorways and access points to our own greatness, because in our vulnerability is where our genius and our greatness lies. So the more you practice honoring your vulnerability and understanding its logic and its ways and its needs, the more amazing you will become. And the better you're going to be able to hold this amazing and complicated and bewildering experience of love and intimacy.
We're so happy to have Ken Page as one of our resident experts here at Flourish. If you'd like to hear more from Ken about how to lead with your authenticity in dating and relationships, he has a program he developed exclusively for Flourish called Deeper Dating, The Powerful Path to Authentic Love, and you can find it on flourishtogether.com. Thank you to all our monthly interview subscribers for listening. Be on the lookout for next month's interview, where we'll bring you another exclusive expert conversation on creating deeply satisfying, rewarding relationships across all areas of our lives.